Hey everyone, if you check your podcast app, you'll probably notice that the show name has changed to Think About Now. There is a reason for that, and it's because it's time to move on. Not moving on from the evils of government or religion, but broadening the scope to include the aspects of our life which are the most difficult to deal with. When I named the show the Libertarian Atheist Podcast, I was purposely putting myself into a bubble that would simply market to an audience that already kind of got it, who wanted their viewpoints validated. In earnest, that's not the worst thing. If you're listening to this show, I imagine getting external validation through political or religious conversations can't be easy. In a world run by insanity, sane ideas are the most difficult to sell, which can make you feel isolated and alone. And sometimes it's not the worst thing to be preaching to the choir on occasion. But in honesty, there's a time to change, and the time to change the name is now. I've been doing this on and off for about 3 years now, podcasting in general. And you know, there's been a lot of listeners and co-hosts and guests who have come and gone. And at the same time, my viewpoints have come and gone as well. What I think about myself and how I think about others has definitely changed over the years. And I got to tell you, if you're not a libertarian atheist, selling someone on opening up their mind by listening to a show called Libertarian Atheist Podcast, it's not easy. Honestly, I can't blame them. If someone said you should listen to the Republican Christian Podcast, I'd probably never listen to it. You see, I want this conversation to grow. And seeing as how it's been myself moving, directing this particular discussion, this conversation, this podcast for a number of years, I know how hard it is just to get people to come on after hearing the name of the show. I don't want to prevent you all from hearing these different ideas because I'm too proud or afraid of just changing the name of a damn podcast. You'll still find the show the same way. It'll be on the same RSS feed, and if you go to libertarian-atheist.com, it'll still get you there. The new name is Think About Now, because that's exactly has been exactly the theme of the show for years now. It's about living authentically in the present, gaining lessons from history but attempting not to repeat, and being cognizant and conscious at all times. From the bottom of my heart, I'm so glad that so many of you have joined me throughout this whole journey. These last 3 years have been some of the most transformative years of my life. And for those who have been, you know, listening since the beginning, you guys have kind of followed me through an evolution of thought. I didn't start off this show stating I knew everything. And so it's been a really challenging endeavor, but a very rewarding one to have come this far. So again, thank you for everyone who's been sharing over the last couple of years here. Now moving on, today I brought in a guest who really helped me shape as a human being. He was the first professor that I ever had while in college who was willing to really debate the most important concepts in the world, while, you know, not passing or throwing aside my viewpoints because, well, obviously politically I was quite a bit different than the majority of liberal professors who are running the university as a whole. His name is Joe Rogers. He has a philosophy and art education from the University of South Carolina and a master's and doctorate degree from Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. He taught for 4 years over at University of Texas, San Antonio, which I think I had him for every single year for multiple classes, and has taught for the past 10 years at the University of Incarnate Word. He's actually in quite a bit of a different place, though, over in Ottawa, Canada right now. So I had him on because I wanted to kind of go into some deeper fields of thought, and I thought, you know, an individual who has a background in theology, he might help me get there. Because I wanted to have someone on who could kind of explain some of the meaningful information, maybe not information, but stories that we can gather from the religions which kind of run the world, namely Christianity. He considers himself a Christian atheist, which I know sounds contradictory to a lot of us, but it is a very interesting viewpoint, and I think that y'all will get a lot from this conversation. So enjoy the show, and keep sharing and donating and doing everything else. Thank you all so much, and here we go. Hello, everyone. So I'd like to start this discussion today with a quote, which is often repeated ad nauseum, honestly to an obnoxious point where people state God is dead, right? Which supposedly came from Nietzsche. And of course, it's without any context. So I want to add some context to it. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? It is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? So within today's world, and me and the guest here were discussing this a little bit earlier, but news and comedy have kind of merged with one another. Where satire has replaced wisdom as certainty has become a relic. Truth only exists to fundamentalists, and to be intelligent is to know nothing. Relativism has replaced absolutes, and hypocrisy is a necessary aspect in the art of persuasion. Feelings over facts and outrage over strength. It's no wonder that so many of us feel so lost. Why risk being wrong when you can criticize anyone who dares to try and make meaning in a universe without God? Packed with frustration without a God, shame is used as a tool to push others down to be as low as you are. Those who've attained greatness have merely taken it from others. Happiness is a delusion. Family is slavery. Civilization is oppression. Humans are a plague. The feelings of loss, they're not anything new. But the amount of information that we can take in to ignore it is. Adrift in a sea of information with limitless frustration, we distract ourselves from ourselves by fighting externalized, ill-defined threats that we have little control over. So how do we find peace? And can the stories of the old, the myths that penetrate nearly all good fiction, help us find answers? In a universe without God, what do we do? And I know that's quite a question to answer, but today we have Joe Rogers. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Now that it's funny, we're communicating over the inner tubes right now. Yeah. You're in the snowiest place in the world, and I am in the place with the best weather in the world.
Yeah. I'm feeling a little jealous now since we've already had, you know, our first snow day about 4 weeks ago.
What's snow day in Ottawa?
Snow days just mean it's usually the first snow of the season. It doesn't shut everything down, but slows it down. And then the next day life goes on like always.
Yeah, except it's negative 30 fucking degrees.
Right. So, it is.
And, no, it's crazy. Out here the other day it got to 65, so we had to put on a scarf.
Oh my god.
It was so cold.
That's summertime. That's summertime here.
Yeah, it was a great day. but I wanted to kind of get back to this. So
yeah.
We would have these conversations, me and you, when I was much younger, you know, like 18 to 20. And you would bring up these ideas that religion, the majority of religions have kind of common similarities in them.
Yeah.
And that, of course, you consistently find certain narratives, one of them being, you know, the hero myth, right? Jesus and a number of other saints. And why is it that you find that there are these similarities?
I think primarily because, like, I think it's part of the human condition. I think there's something within us that seeks out narratives. And we tell and retell the same stories over and over. We just sort of repackage it. I mean, it's no coincidence or no surprise, rather, that, you know, Shakespeare is still going strong and his stuff just keeps getting reinterpreted. Like if you watch any of those, you know, movies that try and put a different twist on some of the Shakespeare stories, people are still interested in that stuff. And I think there's something, I just think there's something inherent in the human condition that likes to tell stories.
Yeah. And I think people also like to think of themselves, at least at this point, that we've kind of gotten away from like large churches and ornamentation and sacrificing and everything else. But then you think about the Avengers movies, where more money has been spent on that than anything ever. I mean,
that
didn't involve killing people. And it's these elaborate showings of the best technology that we possibly have to be shown to millions and millions of individuals that's telling a very basic hero story. I mean, you even have some of the old gods. You have Thor.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. And same thing with the whole Harry Potter universe. I mean, it's the Arthur legend. I was thinking about it too. Even the, like, there's certain elements that you can like connect the dots to, like, say, for instance, the story of say, for instance, Moses. So you have this hero figure who, as a baby, is sent away. And I always make that connection. Well, oh my God, that's just like, you know, Harry Potter. That's just like Superman. That's just like all these narratives that sort of share a common theme. I mean, I don't want to make it like, I mean, the danger, of course, is trying to connect too many dots and say, oh, well, this is just a ripoff of that. I think there is something there to, I think there's definitely something there to that. These common threads.
I certainly don't want to do the point you're bringing up, which is the conspiracy one, like Zeitgeisters.
No. The problem with Zeitgeist is like they get their, they don't even get their narratives right. You know, they don't even get their stories right to begin with. I mean, they make these gross assumptions about the stories themselves that just simply aren't there. I won't even get into that because I know that's not the topic of our conversation.
No, I actually was originally going to have you on just so we could talk about Zeitgeist, because you did do a fabulous presentation, but it was before YouTube, where you just talked to like 40 of us, breaking down every single thing wrong with Zeitgeist. I was like, wow, this would have been great if there was some platform that could have been shared with millions of people. But this was Stone Age of like 2005.
Yes. It's hard to believe how far we've come.
Yes, actually, it really, really is. But at the same time, as you're bringing up with things like Harry Potter and all these other stories, you find these commonalities. Where was it that you found in writing? Now, by the way, you did teach us world religions and
right.
Obviously a philosophy background. Where were these originally writings from? Like, who were the first people who were kind of dragging on this kind of hero mythos story?
Oh, God, I would probably go back to like when our knuckles were dragging the ground and we sat around in caves and around fires and just told stories. I mean, I know one of the, like, when you're looking at, like, say, the philosophy of religion, one of the, when I've taught that course, I always start with, you know, what are the origins of religion? Like, where does religion originally come from? And one of the theories is that it's, people's experience of life turned into stories. So especially around issues of death. So people have this experience in their, you know, these tribal groups where their, you know, loved one dies. And so in order to comfort themselves, they sit around fires and they tell stories. And that some theorists claim that that's the beginning of religion, that religion started when we sat around fires and told stories. I think it can go all the way back to when our, you know, we evolved to such a state that our craniums could think somewhat, you know, abstractly and tell stories.
Well, that certainly makes sense. And I think a lot of the time is, you know, being able to explain the cosmos in a way that our brains can understand, because we are, as far as we know, one of the few species that knows that it knows.
Right.
You know, it's more just being able to just think. It knows that it knows. So we can look out into the stars and just wonder, why are we here on a consistent basis? And we can allow that idea to kind of frustrate us and bring us down. But if you are without the rigors of science, right, which didn't come in until very recently.
Right. Absolutely.
Making up some kind of narrative is a good way to kind of get around that.
Right? Yeah. And I think there's I think the problem comes when we think that, okay, we've come of age scientifically, so we now have no further need for storytelling. And I think that's simply not true. I think, you know, this sort of cynicism, I think, that happens when often people who come from a rationalist or humanistic background, when discussing religion, there's a type of snarky kind of like, this is all bullshit. And somehow we should be beyond this. And I'm not quite sure. I just don't think we will be, just because I think we're, as a species, I think we are storytellers. And so I think the mythology will always be there. It's just constantly going to get repackaged or get reinterpreted in light of what we do know scientifically now.
Yeah. And it is no great wonder that when I was doing a lot of my staunch atheist stuff, that I would do the immediate, you know, shaming and making fun of storytelling and science can explain everything. And it can answer specific questions,
right.
But it doesn't quite answer why we're here in the universe. It doesn't mean that we need faith in order to do that, but stories allow us to kind of construct a reality so that we're not shuttling shuttling all of our emotions and our frustrations onto things that we have no control over. So we're just trying to make sense of the universe.
Now, absolutely. Yeah.
What are some of the major traits that you believe maybe atheists could gain from religious stories?
I think one of the things that like is to go is kind of what I challenge when I challenge, because I, every semester it happens, it happened this past semester, it will happen next semester, is I always get at least one or two strongly fundamentalist, like Christian fundamentalist students. And I'm always challenging them to look beyond the literalness of the story to what is the story trying to get us to. And I think that would be my challenge, oddly enough, to atheists as well. It's what is the story trying to get us at beyond the literalness of the story? Because I think even the people, like, it, of course, it depends on what genre of literature you're looking at. Are we, you know, what religion we're looking at, what text we're looking at. But I think overall, if we look at any sacred text, any narrative within a sacred text, assuming it's a narrative, I am a firm believer that the intent of the authors of those stories was not to try and convey literal or for sure they're not trying to convey scientific truth. So what were they trying to convey? They were trying to convey, I would say, a very humanistic point, which is to lead a good life, to lead a life that has meaning. And I think that's the point of the stories, not that Jesus walked on water, not that, you know, a virgin gave birth, not that those, that's like missing the forest for the trees. You know what I mean? It's like, it's focusing on the wrong thing. And so that's why I would challenge both the religious fundamentalist and the someone coming from a, you know, strictly atheistic viewpoint to approach the stories with fresh eyes.
Yeah. And there are some ways, right? I know how to do it, to weasel your way around that argument, right? Oh, well, then what is Levitican law really telling us, right?
Well, but that's totally different. That's my point is we can't, that's why I was even careful to say the ones that are narratives, like something from Leviticus isn't a narrative at all. It's strictly, there were, you know, codes of living for, you know, for the Jewish tribes. I mean, you always have to look at, well, what specific book are we talking about? What passage are we talking about? You got to be careful with narratives, because the entire body of literature, it's just that. There's a variety of genres, different forms of writing. Yeah. So I would caution against lumping everything into one thing.
Oh, absolutely. I was actually going to bring up that, you know, Levitican law will make sense to people who never got the answer that the germ theory of disease exists. Right. It's trying to make sense of the fact that, you know, all the ooey gooey girls around you keep bleeding out of their vagina. So you're trying to figure out some way of rationalizing and understanding it.
That's right. Absolutely.
I mean, a lot of it.
And also, I think it's important, even with something as I mean, we laugh at it and God, isn't that silly. But even the idea of looking at things symbolically as you know, a preliterate people would. So for them, blood symbolizes life. And here is this, you know, female gender that's just like bleeding. And for them, like, that's a freak out moment. It's like, what does this mean for us? It means there's danger here, because that which sustains life is now somehow being taken away. Again, I'm not trying to justify it by any means. I'm just trying to get into their mindset.
What do you make of the idea, and I have postulated this in the past, and I think there's some proof of it in certain cases, that the majority of religion has been used as a tool to control individuals?
Say that one more time, Carlos.
Okay, that the true basis of religion is merely a tool to control other people.
I don't want to dismiss that, because that is, I mean, all you have to do is take a look at, you know, the history of religions to see that that is absolutely true. But I don't know. I'm not going to say the basis of religion is that. I'm hesitant to go there, only because that suggests that the very reason we have religion is for the control controlling of other people. And I don't think to me, that seems more appropriate for religion after it's been around a while and has become institutionalized. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's difficult to remove difficult to remove the narratives or the massively shaming aspects of the majority of at least Abrahamic religions, right? And you do find a lot of shaming of things like sex, of actual love, of homosexuality to a certain
extent.
But again, I would say it's difficult because there's a plurality of all these things. So when we talk about the Abrahamic faiths, or even let's stick with, like, say, the Old Testament. Let's stick within the Hebrew tradition, with the Judaic tradition. There's a variety of Judaic traditions. There never was just one like way of looking at it. That in fact, I just finished up teaching. In fact, grades are due on Monday. A course on human sexuality within the religious traditions, and it's interesting that when you were talking about this idea of how the Abrahamic faiths approach something like sex, there's not one answer to that. So yes, you can absolutely find portions that are all about, you know, shaming, but then there are other portions within the traditions that are also about glorifying and celebrating the human body and celebrating the pure joy of sex. What's fascinating to me as a religious scholar is that, say, for instance, within the Hebrew scriptures, the book, the Song of Songs, like, there is absolutely, when you read that, it is completely devoid of God. There's no mention of God. There's no mention of angels. There's nothing supernatural about that book. It is simply erotic love poetry. It is a poem that was written erotically, and it's a celebration of sex, and it's found within the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures. So I guess I reject the idea that there is one way of looking at, say, any issue, in this case, looking at sex within a particular religious denomination.
Okay, that does make sense. And when it comes to trying to understand the history of these religions, you bring up not taking specific things literally. Right. Do you believe when individuals are writing these texts, they were actually telling other individuals that it wasn't meant to be taken literally? I thought it would be interesting that maybe somewhere in the Bible would have said, well, yeah, you'll burn in a lake of fire, but we don't mean that literally.
No, of course they're not talking literally. So for instance, the best way I can, you know, give you an example of that would be, here we are, you and I are having this conversation, you know, 2 weeks before Christianity celebrates, right, commemorates the birth of Jesus. Yet if you go back and look at both the Gospel of Matthew, the infancy narratives in the Gospel of Matthew, and the infancy narrative in the Gospel of Luke, they're completely contradictory. They are historically, even just like narratively, they don't fit. So the fact that the early Christian editors, when they're editing this book together, they weren't stupid. They could clearly see that Matthew says has one particular timeline. Luke has an entirely different timeline for how this story came about. They didn't care. They put them side by side, and they did not care, because my theory is they just didn't. They knew they weren't telling literal stories. That's not the point of the stories. They weren't meant to be read literally. The people who wrote them didn't mean them to be read literally. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but so do you think it's a waste of time then to try to figure out the historical verisimilitude of various biblical texts?
Absolutely. What I mean is, as a scholar, I find it fascinating, and I think by studying, say, the archaeology of the time, the history, like who is, like, say, for instance, if we look at, say, the Gospel of Luke, and we look at his infancy narrative, and we study, okay, now who is Luke? Who is this individual? Who is he writing for? What were the I think studying that kind of history, I think, sheds a lot of light onto the narrative itself. But in the end, whether Jesus actually was, you know, born in Bethlehem or born in Nazareth is completely irrelevant.
Okay. That to me, though, is just so interesting because I had this deep fascination with trying to change people's minds but bring up the fact that, you know, Jesus probably didn't exist, which to me, the best argument against like the historical Jesus not existing right. was miracles aren't real. I was like, so if you take out the miracles, it's just a lot of good stories.
And to me, yeah, that's so interesting because to me, like I've certainly heard that argument before. And I've always said, like, so you have this, like at the heart of the Jesus story is this Jewish young man who was an itinerant preacher who went around stirring shit up. Like, to me, you don't like that's like saying there's a cab driver in New York City named Muhammad. I mean, well, of course there's a cab driver in New York City named Muhammad. And I would say the same thing with here. Like, you don't have to make up in first century Palestine, an itinerant Jewish preacher who was, you know, went around preaching and was crucified by the Romans. I mean, you don't need to make that shit up. Like, that happened. Jesus was hardly unique in that. So, I mean, even if Jesus didn't exist, there were 20 or 30 other itinerant Jewish preachers who did the same thing Jesus did, who ended up, you know, having bad endings as well.
Yeah, but it's this obsession with facts or trying to just break down things in a specific way in our minds that right. might lend itself, or at least lend myself to trying to make sense of this Jesus story as if it didn't actually happen, then I can now debunk all these other people and all the Christians will go away. Because Christianity to me, I've discovered this. Christianity to me, though, is very problematic in its ideas of hell, and it was certainly problematic in my own life. I consider my fundamentalism at a young age as a form of trauma, right? Yes. Like trying to understand this universe and deeply believing that if I did something wrong, it could actually burn in hell. And then once that goes away, right, once the idea of punishment goes away, then you're left in this kind of nihilistic setup because you didn't realize that you didn't gather good from bad due to God, right? You just did that because you're a human being and you've been raised, I guess, all right. Instead, it was all based off this punishment model. So you end up lost. And people continue to have that feeling, which is why you know, you'll have conversations with, you know, your average college sociology major, let's say, and you talk about deeper issues like morality or the meaning of the universe and what this means for us and what is good and what is wrong. And there's kind of this seeming passé regarding even the topics of morality or ethics, as if it was something back then, but none of that really applies now, right? And that actually concerns me, though I understand people's fear of things like absolutes, right? I can get that. But the reason for certain religious figures is they are an absolute perfect version of something that we want to attempt to resemble, right?
Yes.
Ayn Rand actually wrote in this way. I didn't like Ayn Rand's writing, but whenever people say, oh, well, none of the characters had any imperfections. Well, it's because she was writing in a religious manner. Right. She was, these are perfect people, these are bad people. Jesus was a perfect character. You know, Satan was the embodiment of evil, although Satan wasn't exactly stated in the Bible. But
right,
you kind of get what I mean there.
And I would even argue Jesus is not presented as a perfect it could certainly even be argued that the gospel writers aren't trying to present Jesus as complete divinity. That came hundreds of years afterwards as Christians reflected on the narrative itself, because Jesus comes across as a human being. Like, he gets pissed off, he gets sad, he gets depressed, he questions his own existence, he questions, believe it or not, the existence of, not so much the existence, but the presence of God. You know what I mean? So I don't think, I think Jesus is a much, as a character in literature, I think Jesus is much more complicated and complex than a lot of, even Christians understand.
Well, I could certainly agree with that point.
Thank you
for that clarification, though.
But I think you hit it on the head, Carlos, earlier when you were talking about the desire for meaning, that somehow in a world that's completely relativistic, there seems to be a desire for something. I mean, I see it in young people all the time today. The sociologists have talked about the rise of what's they call the rise of the nuns. And what they mean by that, I'm sure you've heard that term, is more and more young people now, like when filling out surveys and when asked, what is your religious denomination or religious affiliation, they will put none. Like, in other words, they answer, they don't feel connected to any denomination. And I think, and I believe me, I'm not necessarily lamenting that, because as you mentioned about your child, and certainly there were elements of my own upbringing that were quite traumatic as well, that, like, you know, religion has gotten its reputation as being this abusive force. It's gotten that reputation for a reason. But I think when people are stripped away of that, nothing has meaning, that we can trust in nothing, that you're absolutely right, people are left feeling sort of like a leaf caught in the wind and adrift, and there's nothing there to ground them. And I see that a lot, and I often reflect on how much meaning are they missing in their life. And I think there's a desire for people to have connections, to have meaning.
Yeah. And I know there's been points, obviously, in my life where I've had that kind of questioning. Although I believe I can say that many other people I know who are religious have that exact same feeling a lot of the times as well. There was no more time when I was more unsure of my belief than when I was deeply religious. So the times where I was the most fundamentalist, the most irate, it was because I was projecting out this frustration. I was really mad at other people. I was like, why aren't you believing this? What I was really asking is, like, why aren't I really believing this?
Really? Did you not, during that time, did you not, like, you weren't convinced of your own rightness?
No. But okay. But that's my personality type, kind of.
Right.
I'm never quite sure where I stand in anything, which is why I don't make a very good cult leader. You'll hear me like 1 month, we'll talk about feminism or something, and I'll say something terrible about it. 6 months later, I say something really good about it, and then everyone's left confused, and then I lose about half my listeners. And that totally didn't happen, though. No. But yeah, you're left in this feeling, and then when you become an atheist, for me at least, I started projecting out my frustration onto Christians, and it was like me yelling at my younger self going, how could you be so stupid that you believed this?
Yeah.
So, and in that, though, in that irate anger, you are trying to be the hero in your own life story because you don't really have a hero to look up to.
Right.
So your meaning, right, comes from, at least for me as a man, wasn't so much about caring for necessarily my family, but it was caring for this larger cause that I didn't quite understand. I guess it was everyone became an atheist and then something, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't really sure where we were going to get with it. But I had a kind of idea, and there was this great enemy that I was able to slay with. You would literally say things like the sword of truth or reason. You know, there's all these great analogies that are made, ridiculous things. But although there's obviously some validity, but we're all trying to become the hero in our life story. So we're trying to compare ourselves to something else.
Yeah.
And in that frustration, though, in that failure, you're just kind of left empty again.
Yeah, and I think in some ways, and I mean, you know me. I know your listeners don't know me, but you know me. I'm gonna come off sounding like an apologist, and I'm so not a religious apologist. But I think in some ways that's where religious narrative can come to our rescue. This idea of that a religious narrative can help us, I think, as human beings, connect to each other, can help us develop, find meaning in our life. And what I mean by that is, like, I mean it from sort of almost, you know, from a very philosophical standpoint, this idea that we create meaning for our own lives, not that there's, you know, some cosmic meaning out there, but that it behooves us, as the existentialist said, because there is no ultimate meaning to life, it behooves us to give meaning to our own lives. And I think religious narratives can be a guide in that, and can be quite helpful in that. Again, if we approach it as literature, as narrative.
We do obviously see, though, a lot of issues, though, when you take that to its to where you decide to throw away all new information and decide to rest your mind within these older stories, right?
Can you give me an example? What do you
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and bring up evolution. Well, evolution is not true because the Bible says it's not true. Right.
Well, to me, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a. I mean, anybody who's foolish enough to even claim that. I mean, like
it's the Bible. It's a huge percentage of the population, by the way.
Well, I would say probably in the American, well, in the American mindset, that's probably true. I you know, certainly, I don't think that's true everywhere. But I think like the fact that these stories, and I think that's maybe where to learn the history of these narratives is important. Like the fact that these stories are written in a pre-scientific age, like where they wouldn't have even understood evolution. So how could they be speaking about any sort of science? That it misses the point. You know what I mean? It's like the points of the stories are not to refute science because there was no science to begin with. In other words, people didn't know about evolution at the time. So they're hardly trying to, you know, the narratives are hardly trying to make up for, our, you know, for evolution.
And I can understand that in that context. I can kind of be passe about it, but it is a problem, right? And it's a problem
in the States. I would say it's a problem.
Yeah. Well, and then we have other religions that are a problem in a lot of other countries, right?
Yes, for sure. Another issue.
Yeah. North Africa and Middle East with a large amount of Islamic population that, though we have new information that, guess what? Women aren't lower than men, right? As a whole, they're not worse than, we shouldn't be cutting off parts of their vagina.
That's right.
But Islam to me presents itself as much more illiberal than something like Christianity as a whole.
It's hard not to say that. You're right. I mean, I would agree with you, but I think again, I think this is where humanism comes in helpful. Like, I think there, as we've seen in Christianity, as we've seen in, you know, the blending of humanism and Christianity, the blending of Buddhism and humanism, the blending of humanism and Islam. I mean, they exist in areas my desire, my want is to see it happen even more. Not that one has to choose one over the other. I don't know if I'm making any sense. In other words, it's not like if you're coming towards, so if we're going to have a conversation with people who come from a fundamentalist standpoint, whether it's Islamic fundamentalism or Buddhist fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism, we cannot start with get rid of religion. Religion's bullshit. Get rid of it. It's stupid. You can't start there. You have to, I think what I often do with my fundamentalist students is to show them that there's another way. There's a way to be both Christian and humanist, both Islamic and humanist. Does that make sense? Both secular and religious at the same time.
Would you say, though, that possibly the reason why you do have that with Christianity versus something like Islam is because there was a Reformation?
Right. And there have been reformations within Islam as well. Not certainly, I don't think, on the not on the global scale that you had within Christianity, but I don't necessarily think that's true. You certainly, like within like if you study the history of Spain and Islamic movements within Spain and the reformations within Islam during those periods, I mean, you certainly saw that. You certainly saw, you know, pushes it, you know, for reform within Islam. I think you see it on a much smaller scale today. I mean, I think there are pockets, areas within, especially within the academic communities within Islam that are pushing for reform. But you're right. I would say, yeah, I mean, it's certainly on a geopolitical scale. I would say Islam, as compared to Christianity, could certainly be seen as more problematic for sure.
Well, I mean, it's more problematic just from its founder, right? I would take hang out with Jesus over Muhammad damn near any single day. I mean, you have a warlord, Muhammad. That's what he was. I mean, he'd take over village to village. There's a lot of rationalizations for his actions afterwards. But the dude loved fucking some 13-year-old girls and taking in some prostitutes. And just an overall not a very good view of women and other human beings who did not take to Islam the way that he wanted to. Because he was a to me, Muhammad represented more of a cult leader than Jesus could have. Just in the way, the flavor of the story, the amount of swordplay that was going on. Obviously, that had a lot to do with the culture at the time, but we can say that about any single religion. I mean, Christianity didn't say exactly anything new about, say, the actual founding of the universe, the germ theory of disease, any of these things.
Right.
And neither did Islam strictly, but it did start forbidding quite a bit of extra things. And the very fact that so much of the Quran brings up hell and brings up, you know, bringing down other individuals.
You always have to remember that one builds off the other. So, like, for instance, if you look at the Old Testament, or the, I'm sorry, I keep referring it to the Hebrew scriptures. I want to be politically correct. If you keep looking at the Hebrew scriptures, there is little to no talk of an afterlife. Then when you move to the New Testament, there are hints of it, which is what I kind of chuckled when you were talking about your fundamentalist upbringing and the emphasis on hell. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, that's so such a small smidgen within the New Testament. And then you move the next step, of course, is within the Abrahamic faiths is Islam, which takes it even a step further. You know what I mean? So and then, you know, when you study, say, Christian theology and you look at the Middle Ages, you had a complex theology of different levels of hell. So not only is there hell, there's various levels and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, even just chronologically, one builds off the other. So we should not be surprised to see Islam have a more, I guess, I don't want to say developed, but a more like more talk of those sort of things because one is building off the other.
But the building thing, though, is interesting because if you go ahead and we'll call it the Old to the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
Violence overall is lower and lower and lower amounts, right? Like Jesus is pretty peaceful by the end. And, you know, Abraham was willing to just kill his kid because some guy told him to do so, right? So, and Moses wasn't exactly the most peaceful of individuals. So he got pretty violent towards a preaching of nonviolence. When you have Muhammad, though, throughout his quest, he consistently becomes more and more violent. First, violence is first forbidden completely, then is permitted, and then it almost becomes mandatory in some of the statements he's making. And that, to me, is quite problematic.
For sure. Absolutely. And I'm not going to sugarcoat that, right?
I mean, yeah.
That is absolutely problematic. I guess for, like, if we're looking, you know, if you want to see it as a progression, for sure. I think, too, if we want to look at, say, narratives, can we look at these without stripping away the integrity of what you just said. In other words, acknowledging the violence that's there. But can we look at these narratives differently in light of the fact that we are an advanced people? So, for instance, can we look at the story of the sacrifice of Isaac or the attempted sacrifice of Isaac by his father Abraham as a symbolic story? Does that make sense? So in other words, we're not going to look at these stories literally.
But I don't even know what this symbology of Isaac would be, except, I mean, honestly, it's a pretty, you're willing to sacrifice your son for some intense belief. To me, that's not a good story.
It is if you look at it strictly symbolically. And what I mean by that is there something within your life that you are willing to give up your most precious thing? Now, I know we could sit around and argue, you know, children are not things, and I get that. But what I'm, you know, we've got to get into the mind of a, you know, that children are things in terms of the narrative. So is there something in our lives that you'd be willing to give up anything? Like, is there a value in your life that you hold so deeply that you'd be willing to give up your most precious thing for that?
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. Story of Abraham and Isaac, right?
Yeah. I guess, I mean, I'm trying to take it from your liberal perspective of,
like, yeah, and
not
again,
a, not
I'm
a liberal
not
story.
Like,
and it honestly, it feels slightly like you might be reaching, but we're all reaching.
But I'm saying this again as someone who is, I am a secular, atheist myself. You know what I mean? I'm not in any ways trying to be apologetic. I have been the victim myself of, you know, irrational religious, you know, disgusting belief. So I'm trying to be as approaching these stories as symbolically as I can, and trying to appreciate the narrative as narrative, not as history, but as narrative.
Yeah. And so in the issues of something like the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, where God is sacrificing his only son for us, though I can, in a satirical way, kind of make fun of that. Why, if God is all powerful, would he have to do this in such a violent manner?
Yeah, but, see, I think, though, I don't mean to cut you off. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
But for me, it's about, or at least as I've interpreted lately, the death and the rebirth idea is incredibly important. Because we come from the ashes no matter what we're doing, even if it's a new idea. You know, when something is interjected into my mind, some of the bigger standpoints, while I'm working for CPS, I realize that something I'm doing is wrong. Well, there is a death of this belief system that I have that I'm righteous and I'm good in what I'm doing for other human beings. And that has now faded away and died. And now through a rebirth of bringing myself back up, I can create change in the world.
Absolutely. That's perfect. I think what you were touching on earlier is what's called atonement theology, that somehow we are such rotten, nasty sinners that God had to kill his son because only a blood sacrifice would atone for the horrid things that we've done. That's Calvinism. Like that whole atonement theology, I mean, it found its apex in Calvinism, but that came hundreds and hundreds of years after the writing of the gospel. I am not at all convinced that the gospel writers are writing atonement theology.
Really?
They are people, they are people who are basically devastated that their leader has died, essentially, and trying to figure out, again, we're back to your original position. What can this event, this horrible, horrible event that our, you know, beloved leader was a victim of state-sponsored violence, died at the hands of the government, essentially. What can we make meaning from this horrible event? What can this event mean on a much more profound level? Then you get stories of resurrection. Then you get stories of, I would even say, you know, what in Christian theology is the coming of the Holy Spirit. In other words, this idea that even after the death of this individual, in some weird way, the spirit in, you know, I'm doing little air quotes with my fingers right now, the spirit of this individual is still animating us in some way. That to me is what the story's about. It has nothing to do with God's angry and he's pissed off at human beings and he needs blood sacrifice. I think that's a much, much later historical reading of that narrative that was not the intent of the original authors.
And when did the topic of original sin start settling in?
Oh my God, not until Augustine, not until well into the 5th century. Like original sin, like if you know, Christians will often talk about original sin and they'll start talking about Adam and Eve. And I mean, it happens all the time in my class and I immediately put the kibosh on that. I'm like, okay, guys, like the Adam and Eve story is a Jewish story. It is their story. They wrote it. They get to decide how this story was written and gets interpreted. And they have, Jewish theology has zero concept of original sin. So, I mean, you know, Christians went back and then reinterpreted that story, that Jewish story of Adam and Eve, and came up with, you know, original sin. But that's not what the story's about at all.
Then how did the Jews interpret it?
The Jews interpret it as just humanity is responsible for the shit that goes on in the world. Like, don't blame God, blame people. That's kind of the, in a nutshell, that's how a lot of Jewish theologians would interpret this idea. Like, what is it about human beings? What is, you know, on another level, you could say, what is it about human beings that we just can't Like, as hard as we try, we just can't be these perfect things. What is it about the human condition? And so, you know, you've got this great story about this guy and this girl and this talking snake. And, oh, my God, humans fucked everything up. And look at it. We keep doing it over and over and over again. And then they come back to, you know, the faithfulness of God, that no matter how many times we fuck up, God constantly wants to restart the covenant over and over and over and over again. But humans always fuck up and God always, you know, reestablishes the covenant. And Christians picked up on that language as well, naturally, since, you know, the early Christians were all coming from a lot of them were coming from a Jewish context.
And I actually wanted to take it back to one other point, and just because this is on the top of my head, and I wanted to double check that it was actually legitimate. Do you like Bart Ehrman at all?
Yeah, I do. I like him very much. Yeah.
So he spoke about in the book of John, you ended up having the most amount of original quotes from Jesus Christ, which is right. Interesting because it's a later book.
Right.
And he was stating that part of that was because the religion or the cult, little small cult, was growing, mm-hmm. but they were being pretty much sacrificed or killed for their beliefs. So right. there needed to be a stronger position that Jesus is the Son of God.
Absolutely. In fact, if you compare, say, the Jesus sayings, like when, again, as literature, like when you're comparing the dialogue that Jesus does in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and compare it to how Jesus talks in John, it's only in the Gospel of John where you get Jesus said, "I and the Father are one." Like me and God, when you're looking at me, folks, you're looking at God. That's in John. That is not in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's not even, I would say it's not even hinted at in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Certainly there, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are trying to say, look, Jesus was this real special guy. He had this very intense relationship with God. But John takes it even a step further. And then if you look at Christian history, as the, you know, Christianity starts to develop and develops councils and creeds, and they push that even further and further. And that's, yeah, then you have how you and I started this conversation, the institutionalization of these religions, which is where I think things really start going off the rails.
So when do you think that major switch was from, we take this as a metaphor or as an analogy, mm-hmm. and it switches to a form of fundamentalism where we actually light people on fire or kill people in the name of it?
Well, it's interesting. If you read any of Karen Armstrong's stuff, Karen Armstrong is a firm believer. I like the theory. I don't have anything to refute it. But I mean, Karen Armstrong is a firm believer that fundamentalism is a fairly new thing. That when you and I talk about, say, Christian fundamentalism, what we're really talking about is a reaction that Christianity had to 19th century rationalism. That's when fundamentalism began. So it's her claim is that we often think of fundamentalism as a throwback to like old Christianity, when really she says that fundamentalism is quite new, that it's not a throwback. It's something that's just simply a knee-jerk reaction to the dawn of science and the dawn of rationalism.
So it was simply a reaction to the scientific revolution, which
yes.
started answering some of the questions they thought their religion would have been answering in the first place. And there could have been some contradiction. So they needed to double down.
That's right. That's her position. Yes.
That makes actually a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think it does too. I mean, it's certainly like, especially if you go back and if you read, say, for instance, Irenaeus and Tertullian and Cyprian and all these old Christian thinkers from, you know, like the 5th and 6th centuries, especially when you read their writings on how they interpret scripture, they don't come at it from a fundamentalist viewpoint. They really do talk about these stories from a much more symbolic standpoint, which I think is quite fascinating when you're reading these old, you know, 6th and 7th century documents.
Yeah, that is. And would you find that that was also the case with Hebrew scripture as well as Islamic scripture?
Oh, my God. I mean, even today, like,
Jews now, I mean,
the Jewish rabbis fully embraced scientific rationalism. They had absolutely no problem with it. Like, I think this, especially when you think of like the modern state of Israel and you think of like, you know, the crazy religious right-wing fundamentalist Jews, I would say that is even newer. I would say that's something unique, and new.
Oh, whereas we have a lot of evidence to show that Zionism is a relatively new thing.
Right. And I mean, Jewish theologians had zero problem with 19th century rationalism, like with the scientific revolution. They embraced it. So it's pockets in Islam embraced it as well. I think, unfortunately, the more violent reactionaries have kind of hijacked the religion. But we're still waiting to see what's going to happen in that regards. I think Christianity is moving in that direction. When you look at Christian history, when you look at, say, Thomas Aquinas and the rise of the scholastics in the 12th and 13th centuries, they certainly wanted to embrace this idea of reason over sort of blind faith. They very much embraced that. We lost it soon after in Christianity after them. But I think Christianity is moving back in that direction to re-embrace rationalism and the goals of the Enlightenment.
Well, they have to. They have to change.
Yeah, absolutely. John Shelby Spong said, in fact, he wrote the title of his book was Why Christianity Must Change or Die. I mean, you can't get, you know, basically the entire book is in that one line. You know, either Christianity changes or it dies. Those are your choices. And I agree with him.
Yeah. And certain religions may go more kicking and screaming than others. I've noticed that Christianity, though, and Christian countries as a whole.
Yeah.
Now, and the funny thing is, I almost have to say, besides the United States on almost everything, because, like, well, they're generally more peaceful, except when the United States blows up a bunch of Muslim people in other countries. It's like Sweden, you know, they're kind of Christian, but but actually they're more atheistic now than ever, but a lot of them still go to places like church and things. Although when I was in Scandinavia, I did notice that a lot of churches had been changed to grocery stores, which made for beautiful grocery stores.
Well, even if you remember, I don't know if you remember there in San Antonio, like there were several old churches, especially there on Broadway, that had been or were in the process of being converted into really beautiful condos. You know what I mean? It's gorgeous.
Yeah, there was a few like rock shows. And I think there was a bar called The Church, if I recall, or something like that. And it was like, it was actually a bar. It was pretty hip. religion is shifting in that way as a necessary. And when it comes to Islam, though, because Islam's history with science is quite interesting, because though some people bring up, well, there was this great scientific revolution within Islam in the 9th, 10th century. But a lot of that was is Islamic groups taking over areas where that was already kind of starting.
That's natural. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the Hindus were the ones that came up with zero. It wasn't like Muslims out of nowhere just like zero. Yeah. And you know, the translations of Greek texts, a lot of that was being done by Christians who then converted to Islam.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't, it was either pay the jizya or, you know, possibly die. So there was reasons to convert.
Absolutely. And that's the history of religions. Like, I mean, I always, like, to me, it's never a surprise. You find that in groups of people, you find that in politics, you find it it's everywhere. Like I don't think these are things that are endemic to religion. I think, you know, change or die. Like, I mean, that's the history of, you know, that's, as you mentioned, you know, the United States doesn't have exactly a pristine history when it comes to, you know, invading other countries. Does that make sense?
It does.
I like to think of religions often like nationality, like countries. You know, they're fraught with violence, and sometimes they're peaceful, and sometimes the history of a particular country is horrible to minorities and horrible to women. And, you know, when you look at even founding constitutional documents within a country's history, it sounds very noble. You know, when you read the, you know, the founding fathers of the United States and all these noble, lofty democratic ideals, but they only included, they were only really only talking about white men. And as a result, the country had to change. The country had to widen its scope. And I think that that happens to religions as well. They have to change. They have to widen their scope. And I think that's happening. I think that's why when I hear fundamentalists kind of gnash their teeth, I'll speak even within the Catholic tradition of, you know, these, oh my God, everybody's leaving the church. What's going to happen? Well, you're gonna have to change. You're gonna have to adapt. You will adapt. That's what's going to happen. It's going to happen. All religions change. They just do.
Yeah. And they kind of have, as you've already brought up, they have to change. What's always kind of concerned me, though, is that with the moderate religious position is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of logic about when to change, except to kind of maneuver around which parts to keep depending on, you know, the problem with that, though, is that when you depend on the sways of modernity, you end up with a kind of democratic relativistic nihilism, right?
Yes.
Like that's the disconcerting aspect. And then you can always jump back and go, if you want to play the game of one, either you say, well, that's just your opinion. And that's why I don't like playing that game of that's just your opinion, because some things aren't opinions.
Right.
And sometimes opinions matter more than other ones.
Like, yes.
If we're going to say murdering is a matter of opinion, whether or not it's right or wrong, that's an important one. Yep. So whenever you add divinity to any claim, it then makes it unquestionable, right?
Yes.
So you can manipulate that due to its obtuse nature on a consistent basis. And though, you know, aspects of civilized society have begun to include a respect for human rights, at least kind of horizontally, from like peer to peer, rather than a fascistic government towards its people, because they don't really respect rights all that much when they throw millions of black men and women into jails for smoking pot.
Right.
The moderate positions of Christianity are also starting to reflect a lot of those as well. Right? And so that's disconcerting to me. And so when you're explaining to fundamentalists, you know, about leaving the faith, and you call yourself a kind of a secular atheist, but at least last time I remember talking to you, you called yourself, it was like a Catholic atheist or something.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's
why are you choosing to identify yourself with a particular religion if you've already lost the divinity of it, and not just try and get the best out of these different stories, much like me watching the Avengers and then reading Harry Potter. I don't call myself an Avengerite or a Harry Potterite or whatever terms they use.
Yeah, I think my answer to that question, Carlos, would be like you're starting with the faulty position. In other words, you're starting with this idea that somehow Christianity cannot, like Christianity, if you remove God or remove some sort of supernatural, you know, overarching divinity from that, that you can't have Christianity with it, without that. And I strongly disagree with that. There's a whole body of school around individuals who, you know, in this school of thought, who would, they call themselves, I think the word they use is Christian non-realists. This idea that somehow the propositional underpinnings of the faith or the religion do not rest on supernatural propositions. I don't know if I just answered your question or
you kind of did. It's just you're introducing all these things that I think a lot of the listeners will be new to.
I would recommend there's several thinkers. There's even a website. They do national conferences every year. They produce a magazine. It's called the Sea of Faith Network. The founding member is, I believe he is still alive. His name is Don Cupid, or Cupid. And the Sea of Faith Network, basically their premise is they celebrate religion as a human invention. They are primarily coming from the Anglican tradition. There are some Catholics as well. But they're mainly coming from the UK and from Australia. Another individual you might be interested in reading is Lloyd Gearing, who's written extensively. In fact, he's done a lot of YouTube stuff. Again, he's probably pushing 90 now, but he's still alive and he still does interviews, and he's quite a fascinating guy. In fact, one of his most famous books is called Christianity Without God, and basically just kind of lays out the reasons why belief in God basically has been assumed to be an irreplaceable, like, foundation of various faiths, but he disagrees with that. And he talks about, you started out talking about Nietzsche, and he talks about, you know, whether this death of God, you know, means that all of Christianity is going to collapse, and he claims it is not. It's interesting.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to recommend? Because I monopolized about an hour of your time. There was a lot more I wanted to get into.
Oh my God, this is so much fun for me. Yeah. If you're looking for sort of, you know, this brand of, I would call them secular, cultural Christians, in the same way that we now talk about, say, atheist forms of Buddhism and atheist forms or non-theistic forms of Judaism. I think Christianity is moving in that direction. It would be the Sea of Faith Network. Really, really nice place to start.
Well, thank you very much, sir. And
you're welcome.
It was a pleasure to have you on. Wrote any books? Is there any website? Is there any things that you'd like to plug about yourself?
Not a thing.
Narcissistic universe.
I know. No, not at all. I do not want to plug anything of mine. I'm happy to just be the anonymous college professor.
I like the anonymous college professor. That works out. That's what we'll title it. All right. Well, thanks, Joe.